For Silicon Valley Parenting, this is Sarah Lise Sterland. In the past few years, many in the world of education have been telling us parents and students not to stress out about which college our kids get into. Well, Paul Tough, author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, is here to tell us, not so fast.
What his research has showed is this enormous research project that he and colleagues have done, where they've looked at this IRS database and shown how over the course of decades, the relationship between your income as a child, your family's income as a child, and your income as an adult is affected by the decisions that you made and the decisions that were made for you in those years right after high school. And what he finds is that where you go to college matters a whole lot. It matters.
In his new book, Tough shares some of the latest academic research on the effect that higher education has on American socioeconomic mobility. Then he explains the flaws that prevent the system from being one that provides everyone with equal opportunities. His basic point is that these days, everyone needs to attend a college. The Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics supports this argument. Numbers from 2017 show that young adults who didn't have a college degree were four times as likely to be living in poverty than those who did. And the unemployment rate for those with only a high school education in the United States is double that of those with a bachelor's degree. But where we go to college also matters. Using the IRS and historical Social Security number data, Harvard economist Raj Chetty and his team found that students who attend ultra-selective colleges in the United States are much more likely than other students to become very rich as adults. How rich? By their mid-30s, 20% or 1 in 5 of these students have a chance of earning more than $630,000. People who attend other elite universities have a 1 in 11 chance of hitting that number, and students at community colleges, meanwhile, have a 1 in 300 chance. Students who don't attend college have a 1 in 1,000 chance. But this book isn't about attending elite institutions to get rich. The point of these numbers is to highlight the increasing chasm between those who are given the chances to get rich if they want to, and those who are completely shut out. And in the process of learning about why all this is happening, we also learn about what's driving the higher education testing and admission system, something which I imagine that every parent wants to know. Chetty and his team's research shows that kids who grew up rich earn only a bit more than their college classmates who grew up poor, Tough reports. The problem is that the data shows that the rich and the poor don't attend the same institutions in the United States. On average, more than two-thirds of undergraduates at the top Ivy League universities grew up rich, and fewer than 4% of students grow up poor. And if you really want to know, the most financially elitist colleges are Princeton and Penn. Through interviews with a wide spectrum of college-bound kids, education reformers, and admissions counselors, Tufts' work illustrates why it's easier for kids who have well-educated and wealthier parents get into college. He also explains why the SAT and ACT testing systems are flawed, and an increasing number of colleges are abandoning these tests as true measures of a worthwhile student. But Tough's book isn't a book of dry economic research. We meet bright students born into difficult circumstances who make the leap to challenging universities. We meet the president of Prep Matters, a college prep company in the DC area, who charges $400 an hour as a tutor, but admits the SAT and ACTs, or as a measure of student academic achievement, are stupid, silly, and a bunch of malarkey. We meet frustrated college admissions counselors who explain why the predictive analytics and yield rate-driven admissions process results in a situation where the admissions staff spends more time looking for low-performing, high-income students and the reverse, as one book review put it. And we learn of the work of a few dedicated professors in college who have created innovative teaching systems to reach out to struggling students. Through interviews with a wide spectrum of college-bound kids, education reformers, and admissions counselors, Tufts' work explains exactly why it's easier for kids who have well-educated and wealthier parents to get into college. He also explains why the SAT and ACT testing systems are flawed and why an increasing number of colleges are abandoning those tests as true measures of a worthwhile student. But Tufts' book isn't a book of dry economic research. We meet bright students born into difficult circumstances who make the leap to challenging universities. And we meet the president of Prep Matters, a college prep company in the DC area who charges $400 an hour as a tutor, but admits that SAT and ACTs as a measure of student academic achievement are stupid, silly, and a bunch of malarkey. We meet frustrated college admissions counselors who explain why the predictive analytics and yield rate-driven admissions process results in a situation where the admissions staff spend more time looking for low-performing, high-income students rather than the reverse, as one book review put it. And we learn of the work of a few dedicated professors in college who've created innovative teaching systems to reach out to struggling students to keep them in college. In short, the book's an eye-opener and I highly recommend it. Tuff is a former New York Times Magazine editor, and this is his fourth book on kids and the American education system. His previous books include How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, Helping Children Succeed, and Whatever It Takes. Welcome to the show, Paul, and tell us how you got into this literary venture of yours.
So this is my fourth book. I've been writing about education and economics in some form for more than a decade. But this is the first time that I've really written about higher education. And it took me a long time to figure out it. Higher education I find to be a very complicated topic. So it was 6 years ago that I really started work on this book. I took some twists and turns along the way. But that was sort of the full reporting experience. And right. And in some ways, it is obviously a book about college. But really, what I feel like it's a book about at its heart is social mobility. Is this right. this process which exists on both a sort of economics level and a personal level of transcending your background, of becoming in adolescence and young adulthood somebody different than how you grew up. And that is you ask economists about mobility, they measure this in a very specific way. They measure what your family's income was when you were growing up and what your income is as a young adult. And if you make more than your parents did, you've experienced upward mobility. But on a personal level, mobility is just about these changes and transformations that young people go through, and they have a lot to do with identity and with family and with history. So the opportunity to both explore these political economics issues that seemed like such a big deal in our country, they seemed connected to everything from media to the presidential campaigns, and at the same time, visit with young people who are going through these remarkable personal transformations, that seemed like a great opportunity.
How did you get to this theme of social mobility?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was this combination of sort of the personal and the political. There's a way I think that I've been interested in mobility in everything that I've reported before, just that right. that question of how young people change. But I think what's new for me, as I looked at the data and tried to talk to economists and understand what was going on, what's new is that mobility now comes down more than it ever did in the past to these few years after high school. At this moment, where young people are just sort of biologically going through these remarkable changes and psychologically kind of becoming independent and figuring out their relationship with their past and their family and their parents. And the fact that those two things are now happening at the same time and sometimes in the same place, that felt like an important deal and a great story to get a chance to tell.
Okay. Did you have to go with such a dramatic title, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us?
You're not a fan of superlatives. So I think the reason that I took this sort of literary license with the title is that even if in, you know, sort of brain development, those first 3 years of life are the most important, in terms of mobility, in terms of who we become as adults, it's those years right after high school that are the most important. And so that's what I was drawn to for this book.
Can you explain to us just a broad summary of why it makes or breaks us?
Sure. I mean, I think, so I talked to not only lots of students, but also economists and sociologists, and they look at this through a slightly different lens. But I think both of those lenses are really important. And so economists, they just look at the numbers. I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley, actually, at Stanford, working with Raj Chetty, reporting on him, speaking to him and some of his colleagues. He's now taken off for Harvard, but at the time he was at Stanford. And he, I think, is the best and most significant economist when it comes to analyzing mobility in the United States right now from a strictly empirical, number-based, data-based approach. And what he, his research has showed is this enormous research project that he and colleagues have done where they've looked at this IRS database and shown how over the course of decades, the relationship between your income as a child, your family's income as a child, and your income as an adult is affected by the decisions that you made and the decisions that were made for you in those years right after high school. And what he finds is that where you go to college matters a whole lot. It matters more for low-income students than it does for high-income students. And when two students from very different backgrounds, a high-income and a low-income student, go to the same highly selective institution, that experience of going to that college mostly erases the difference in their family background. The two of them tend to earn the same amount when they're, or almost the same amount when they are in early adulthood. And so what Raj shows is that higher education is this great, can be this great engine for social mobility, but at the same time, it is also, it just serves that function very rarely because most highly selective institutions admit many rich kids and very few poor kids. It's one of the remarkable things about higher education, one of the depressing things about higher education, is that it's the most selective institutions that consistently admit the fewest low-income and working-class kids, despite what Raj Chetty showed, that they are actually the most effective at producing social mobility when they do bother to let in any low-income or working-class kids. And so then that's sort of when I move from the economics perspective to the sociological perspective, because it's sociologists who have studied what it's like to be a low-income student attending one of these highly selective institutions because you're surrounded by rich kids. And so if you are a first generation student, if your parents didn't go to college, if you come from a working class or low income family, and you end up at one of these most selective institutions, it is just a jarring experience because you're suddenly surrounded, you know, you've spent your whole life, you know, around people like you, and suddenly you're in a place where there's nobody like you, where everyone seems to have played the same sports in high school, and, you know wear the same clothes and know the same cultural references. And for so many low-income and first-generation students, it's just like a landing on a foreign planet.
Yeah, I think, and how they react to it and how they probably makes or breaks that individual as well. I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the things that you describe in this book, I could relate to. I'm sure lots of other people could relate to. It's just that perhaps it's more extreme for people who've had difficult circumstances growing up.
I think that when students come from a first generation or a low income family and they end up at one of these institutions, it is just more jarring. It's more confusing. They don't have the same kind of resources to deal with. They're not given the same kind of resources to deal with that sort of culture shock that they often experience when they arrive on those campuses.
Right. So there's all these things that are stacked against them as you've documented in the book, and I urge everyone to read it because we're just scratching the surface here. I don't think we're going to be able to cover everything. It's an enormous amount of research that Paul did. So But I also want to drill down a little bit more in terms of, you had loads of data in there about what kind of students do well in which, in different colleges. I mean, in the top colleges, like you said, if a low-income disadvantaged student goes to a very good college, they tend to do pretty much the same as well-off kids. Similarly to well-off kids in terms of income. What else did you find?
Well, I think the flip side of that is that they're not attending the same institutions. So
right.
Raj's data, there's sort of four main findings that I talk about in the book from Raj Chetty's data.
Yeah.
The first three are about the power of social mobility and the power of higher education to propel social mobility. The fourth one is that it just doesn't happen very often, that mostly these highly selective institutions are not admitting many low-income students, and those students, low-income students in the country as a whole, are mostly attending the least selective institutions, community colleges and non-selective public universities. And those are the institutions that we as a society have taken resources away from, especially over the last 10 years, but more broadly as well. So at the same time, we are pouring resources, private and public resources, into the most highly selective institutions. I write about this this fundraising campaign that Harvard undertook a few years ago as I was reporting the book. It was the biggest, most expensive, most ambitious higher education fundraising campaign in history. And it was a five-year campaign to raise like $6.5 billion, and they did it 2 years, and then they just kept raising money and ended up with almost $10 billion. And you know, this is at the same time that we are cutting resources for the institutions that need that help the most and the institutions where low-income students go. So there is a huge disparity exists in both the public and the private realm. And that's the problem. Like, we know that higher education, when we put kids in the same kind of institutions, they end up with the same sort of results, but we're not. We are segregating and stratifying higher education to a remarkable degree, much more than we ever have in the past.
But to some extent, you're just talking about the really bright and motivated kids in low income, in places like Appalachia and inner cities and things like that, right? I mean,
well, in part of the books, I am. I mean, I definitely talk about. You know, have sections and chapters of the book where I'm talking about those kids. There's one young woman from North Carolina who I follow through her freshman year at Princeton. She is, you know, a true rarity, right? But I feel like her story is amazing and important.
Yeah.
But there are other chapters where I talk about those students who didn't much like high school and are much more sort of on the line of like, well, what should I do after I get out of high school? College does not seem particularly appealing, but at the same time, not getting any kind of post-secondary credential, they quickly come to understand in our contemporary economy means, you know, a series of low-wage service or manufacturing jobs and no sense of economic stability. So from a public policy point of view, that's where I think we need to put our focus. And that's actually the chapter in the book that I think is the most important one, because, you know, what happens at those most exclusive institutions is important and needs to change, but it inevitably only affects a pretty small number of students in general and low-income students in specific. And it's the institutions that those public institutions that are most likely to serve those low-income students who aren't particularly excited about, you know, philosophy class, but still need some kind of credential to get a better job than they could get with just a high school degree.
Right.
It's them for whom we have done the worst job of providing a decent pathway to some kind of credential that can get them to the next step.
I don't know if this is, might be beyond the scope of the book, but I mean, in terms of where to look for action, is it the federal or state level?
So the federal government does have some impact, but it's state governments that have a bigger control over what happens in education. The federal education department just isn't that powerful.
Right.
But at the very end of the book, the conclusion that I reach is that our system of higher education is so decentralized, so fragmented, so autonomous, that there isn't any one institution or politician or leader who can change things overnight. If we want things to change, if we want higher education to again be the kind of engine of social mobility that it has been in previous eras of American history, this is something that needs to change on lots of levels at once. Students certainly can have a big impact in terms of how they interact with their campuses. Alumni, especially of highly selective institutions, can do a huge amount to influence the way that those institutions admit and enroll and graduate students. Right. And then I think we all can make a difference in how we vote, in what we tell our politicians. Right, right now, politicians over the last decade have somehow gotten away with cutting these higher education budgets at a moment when so many young people need more credentials and need more help, and they shouldn't. And I think they're not feeling the pressure from us voters to say let's do things differently.
So as parents, we could be a bit more active in that realm.
Yeah, absolutely. I think parents are another really important constituency. And I think that they're, you know, there's all parents, but especially I think affluent parents right now, yeah, just feel under an enormous amount of pressure in terms of college admissions. They, yeah, feel like college admissions is this amazingly competitive, zero-sum, winner-take-all kind of game. Right. And I relate to that and, yeah, can sympathize with that. But at the same time, I think that there are other moments and other eras where we have thought about education and higher education differently, as something that is collective and not individual, as something that is cooperative and not competitive. And if we can sort of keep that in mind, especially those of us who are benefiting from this system as much, right, as we are, if we can keep that in mind and make decisions accordingly, I think we're much more likely to shift gears. But right now, I mean, the problem with a competitive system like this, like the one that we've all sort of created, is it tends to snowball. And I think that's what happened when you look at the admissions scandal from earlier this year. Right. That's really what I took away from it. It was this moment when all of these parents felt like, you know, everybody else is cheating, basically, is, you know, is twisting, yeah, the system, is taking advantage of the advantages that privileged people have. I've got to go the extra mile, too. And in that case, the extra mile was actually illegal. Right. So that matters that they crossed that line and actually broke laws. I think so many parents feel some smaller, more legal version of that same feeling, that this is an unfair system. Maybe it's tilted in our favor, but if it's me versus the, you know, parent down the road, I've got to fight with the same weapons that they're fighting with. And that has just led, I think, to a system that's not only toxic for the health of our country and the health of our democracy, it's also toxic for a lot of young people. I think it puts a lot of pressure on individual young people, especially in affluent towns and neighborhoods, they're sort of the instruments of this amazing competition. Right. And that's really not what you want to do when you're an adolescent. That's not the experience you want to have.
But so what's the answer? I mean, just going back to the your original point, of people who aren't particularly interested in high school and not, they might want to go to a vocational college, like what was his name, Ori Henning,
Kim Ori. Hennings,
yeah. So tell us about the story of Ori Henning and why you told it, and to illustrate your point about giving more opportunities to people.
So Ori is a young man in this town called Taylorsville in Western North Carolina, who I met actually through his sister, who was one of these, you know, super, right, high achieving students. I met her. She was a junior when I met her. She was in high school at this public high school at a pretty low income town in the, right, mountains. But she was this super ambitious, high scoring, super student, who was aspiring to some kind of life through college. And Ori was not. Ori graduated second from the bottom of his class. He came from a sort of shattered home and felt like that influenced the way that he lived and the choices he made as a teenager. And so he got out of high school and he just wanted to do anything other than college. He tried to join the Marines and then he tried to join the Navy. That didn't work. And then he spent a few years working in the kind of jobs you can get in Western North Carolina if you don't have anything more than a high school degree, which is he changed oil at a garage. He worked in fairly low wage manufacturing jobs, and got fired from a few of them, and had really tough schedules and tough wages. And by the time he was in his early 20s, he was feeling pretty stuck. So it was at that moment that his girlfriend at the time found a brochure for the local community college and said, what about this? Maybe we should go back to school. And at first, that seemed like a crazy idea. School was the thing he wanted to get away from. But he saw there was a welding program and he'd done some welding. So I followed him over the course of the next couple of years as he tried to get a welding degree from the community college in his community. And and it was rough. He did great in lots of ways and he became a much better welder. But there was sort of an idea going around, especially in certain political circles at that point, that welding was this great alternative to college. It was the reason why kids like Ori didn't need a college degree, because they could just go out and become welders. Right. And he found that there were really two things wrong with that idea. One was that you do need a college degree in order to become a welder. Right. And it was, North Carolina is one of those states that was really cutting a lot of funding to its higher education institutions. Right. And the other was that even when you get that degree, welding is not the super lucrative profession. It's a great profession in lots of ways, but this is not a country that is set up right now to reward work that doesn't come with a higher education degree. And so he was never able to make a ton welding, and he's not in a very different place than he was before he started this degree program at his community college. So the reason I wrote about Ori and the reason I just went on about him is that I felt like, his story just on a personal level was, I found fascinating and interesting. It gave me all sorts of insights into the politics and economics of him and people like him. But at the same time, I felt like he was But at the same time, I think the reason that I was drawn to his story was that it gave me this way of understanding his experience, not just his experience, but the broader experience of kids like him. And this argument that, kids just don't, not everybody has to go to college, that there's lots you can do with a high school degree. That is just not true in the economy right now. And it's kids like Ori, young people like Ori, who are really suffering as a result.
Tell me a bit about tell our audience a little bit about the SAT and the testing system, the admission system, and why that is kind of not satisfactory. I mean, even, lots of people from a completely different perspective think that the SAT's system and the whole US News and World Report system is toxic, or it doesn't really work and it screws everything up for everyone. But tell us what you found and why it's problematic.
Sure. Well, so you're right. So for a long time, there has been a lot of reporting about the correlations between the SAT and the ACT and family income. So this goes way back, that rich kids do better on those standardized tests than poor kids. And your SAT score is much more correlated with your family income than your GPAs, than your high school grades are. And yet we have a system right now where higher education admissions depends a whole lot on your test score. A lot of people have found that it is the most important factor that colleges use when they choose who to admit, despite evidence that it's not actually the best predictor of how well kids are going to do in college or after college. There's something about that nice, neat round number, I think, that is very appealing to admissions officers. And it also, because of the power of the U.S. News rankings of colleges, And those rankings are highly dependent on SAT and ACT scores. There's a real incentive for admissions offices to put a lot of emphasis on SAT and ACT scores when they're making their decisions. So during the time that I was working on this book, the College Board was undertaking an attempt to kind of rebrand the SAT and to change its reputation. There was a new president, a man named David Coleman, and he wanted the SAT to be seen as this instrument for social mobility and for social equity. And so he introduced a number of interventions and innovations that was designed to counter this longstanding effect, this longstanding correlation between family income and SAT scores. And a lot of them, I think, were well-meaning and well-intended, but they mostly did not have much of an effect. And my feeling, as I report in the book, is that I think they mostly serve to just distract people from the power that the SAT and the ACT has, not just to decide who gets admitted, but to perpetuate a lot of the class divisions that students bring with them to the college admissions process. Right. So one of the things that was happening while I was reporting was that more and more colleges were going what they call test optional, offering students the opportunity to apply without the college considering their SAT or their ACT score. And what I found in lots of different colleges is that gave admissions people the opportunity to consider students more holistically, and especially low-income and first-generation students to look at their full academic potential and not just what this one number suggested about them.
But you point out that the most exclusive colleges like Princeton haven't done that, right?
That's right. There are a number of more selective institutions that are making that shift. The most selective one to do it so far is the University of Chicago, which just made the switch in the last couple of years. But you're right. No Ivy League or equivalent institution has made that choice yet. My feeling is that might happen in the next few years. And I think when it does, it could create a real domino effect. Right. But so far, those institutions have not taken that plunge.
Didn't you have a few lines in your book about the fact that you think they want to keep it exclusive?
Yeah, there's an admissions person named John Bockenstedt, who was one of my most valuable sources and guides in understanding enrollment management and admissions. He publishes a couple of blogs where he posts his opinions and ideas and data about higher education admissions, and that was a line of his that made a lot of sense to me. That when you look at the most wealthy, the most selective institutions, the ones with the biggest endowments, they really could afford to let in a lot more high-performing, low-income students. But they don't. They, in fact, let in fewer than anywhere else. And it makes him wonder, and makes me wonder as well, whether really what we mean by elite is uncluttered with poor people. I think that was his phrase.
Why didn't they? I mean, surely you ran all this past the admissions office. I mean, did they have anything to say about it?
Well, when you talk to admissions people at these institutions, they point to statistics in through a different lens, and they, you know, make a lot of claims to be more and more diverse. Right. It's when you look sort of beneath the hood at those numbers that it doesn't look that well. I think that was Raj Chetty's most important contribution. He enabled us to sort of cut through the rhetoric that a lot of those highly selective institutions use when they're talking to the press and the public about how diverse they are, how much they seek out low-income and first-generation students. And he was able to show in sheer numbers, you know, no, you're just not admitting those students. You know, something some of these most selective institutions, like 2 or 3% of their student bodies come from the lowest economic quintile, from the bottom fifth of American families. And so that, I think, just made it more difficult for these institutions to make the kind of claims they have in the past.
And his research comes from Harvard.
It does. Well, Stanford and Harvard. Yeah. So, yes,
which
these institutions do know
changed.
What's out there.
Yeah, which haven't changed their criteria.
No.
So just can you tell us a bit about some of the efforts that have been made to change things?
Sure. So yeah, there's a chapter in the book where I talk about efforts to do two different things. One is to create more of a sense of belonging for low-income first-generation students at those most selective institutions. But the other is to improve graduation rates at the less selective institutions, including quite good public institutions, but community colleges as well, which have right now very low graduation rates. And, there's definitely no silver bullet in that, right. In this realm. There is no one intervention or institution that I think has got it entirely right.
Right.
But there are some institutions that I think are doing a great job of changing the environment that students come into. And it mostly comes down to belonging. I think that's kind of a touchy-feely word, and it seems sort of unscientific, but they're taking a very scientific approach to that unscientific concept.
And in your book, you mentioned one particular guy called Uri Treisman. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah, Uri Treisman.
Uri Treisman, who makes these epic efforts to help first-generation college students stay in. In this realm of trying to fix things and trying to make the environment more equitable and make people feel like they belong, he did a lot in your book. What he does seems very, very intense. Do you think that's replicable across at scale in colleges across the nation?
I think some version of what Uri is doing is absolutely replicable, yes. I mean, I think, like any great teacher, he is kind of one of a kind.
Right.
But what he, he's in his early 70s. He's this math professor at the University of Texas in Austin.
Right.
I spent a whole semester following his calculus class, and particularly following the path of this one student, a young woman from San Antonio named Yvonne Martinez. And yes, in lots of ways, why I was there and what I found was that Uri is one of a kind, and it's hard to imagine another professor who's just like him. But so much of what he and others are doing is trying to replicate him, trying to create sort of a community of practice of others who can do the same sort of teaching that he does, and trying to create a playbook that would let them do this kind of teaching. And what really struck me in Uri's work is that a lot of it does seem, amazingly skilled and incredible to watch. But in some ways, it's real common sense. It's sort of about human connection. And it's really not that much of a surprise that what young people need is that kind of human connection. And when they have an adult somewhere in that college community who really conveys to them in a way that they believe, that this person cares about me, wants me to stay here, believes I can succeed here, makes me feel like I belong here, that has a huge impact on how likely that student is to succeed and to graduate.
I wondered, one of the things that struck me was the story of Ned Johnson, the president of Prep Matters in Bethesda and Maryland, and he's got offices in McLean, Virginia, basically around D.C. And he goes to parents pay him $400 an hour to coach their kids who go to places like Sidwell Friends, these exclusive high schools. I mean, should these college counselors be banned? I mean, obviously, it probably won't. You can't ban a college counselor, but how could we get over that? Or should we make those kind of college counselors available to everyone? Should they be funded?
So in my opinion, no, Ned should not be banned. And he talks about this a little bit at the end of chapter 3, he's talking about the role that people like him play in the system. And he says, as long as we are putting as much emphasis in college admissions on an SAT and an ACT score, there are going to be people with money who want to take advantage of the system. And that's where people like me and my tutoring center are going to play a role.
Right.
So the corruption in the system for him is not in the tutoring. It's in the admissions. It's in the decision that we've made to put so much emphasis on this one test or these two tests, both of which you can study for, and that a good tutor can raise your score in. I think the College Board knows it. I think the parents know it, and I think the admissions folks in these different institutions know it as well. If you are coming from one of these communities, you're quite likely to be taking part in that kind of test prep, and you're going to have an elevated, inflated SAT score as a result. And so I think that putting the same kind of emphasis that we have in the past on those test scores for admissions just doesn't make sense. When you see what happens, what Ned is able to do, it doesn't make sense to take those tests as seriously as we do. And that's exactly Ned's message. I mean, to his credit, he is saying that this system that, you know, provides him with a living is basically broken. Right. And he thinks that we should be doing things very differently.
Okay. Well, one last question. One thing about your message of your book that sharply contrasts with another interview I did was about, I just spoke to Julie Lithcott-Hames a few months ago. She wrote a book called How to Be an Adult. And she used to be a dean of freshmen at Stanford. And she spent a lot of time telling me that it doesn't really matter where you go undergraduate. And then she has a massive list at the end of her book that shows where kids went to college at an undergraduate level, and some of them are not very famous ones. And then they end up going on to graduate school, and they go to, you know, the Ivy Leagues and all that. So, but here you're saying it does matter where you go. So what would you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, so that's two different perspectives coming right. out of Stanford, right? It's yeah. hers right. and it's Raj Chetty's. And it right. you know, sort of proves that point that, like, the plural of anecdote is not data, right? Right. Raj did, yeah. he didn't look at the exceptions to the rule. He looked right. at the rule, and he looked right. at what happens when students go to an institution like Stanford. Right. And what happens is they get rich. Right. And he's able to show that mostly they get rich. Mostly Stanford is admitting very wealthy students, and they are getting still wealthier from the experience of going to Stanford. And so I feel like Stanford benefits from the message that, you know, it doesn't really matter that all these rich kids are getting into Stanford, because, you know, wherever you go, you're going to do fine. But the parents who are spending so much money to train their kids and tutor their kids to get them into Stanford, they know, they can read Raj Chetty's data. Right. And even before Raj Chetty's data came out, they knew that it was true. Okay. That going to the Stanford is choosing almost entirely a class of almost entirely rich kids, and they are giving them benefits that they're not giving to the students they don't admit. So
say benefits, I think that's an interesting point. I'm not going to drag this on, but to be clear, when you say you have this really interesting notes in your book about how much each college spends on kids, so the more exclusive they are, the more money they spend on each kid.
Yeah, and so I think that another Stanford economist, Carolyn Hawksby, has showed that, right. you know, Stanford is doing a good job in their economics department of showing how valuable a highly selective education is. I think that for any individual student, I do think that it's a good message to say, like, it doesn't, you know, whether or not you get into Stanford is not going to decide whether you succeed or fail. But right. what I object to about, you know, folks from Stanford saying it doesn't really matter where you go is that, so I feel like when Stanford says, you know, it doesn't matter where you go, they are sending a different message to their parents and their students and alumni than they are sending to the public as a whole.
Well, just to be clear, that she was a former dean. I mean, she made these comments right. after she left. So, but anyway, thanks so much, Paul, for your time and your patience. Really appreciate it. Love your book.
Thank you so much.
That was the September 9th, 2019 edition of Silicon Valley Parenting with Paul Tough, author of The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Thanks so much for listening, and please subscribe and rate this podcast on iTunes or wherever you tune in. I've got other interviews coming up with several other authors. They include Lenora Chu, author of the brilliant book Little Soldiers, An American Boy, A Chinese School, and The Global Race to Achieve. I have a very lively discussion with Julie Lithcott-Hames, a former freshman dean at Stanford, author of How to Be an Adult. And I have a discussion with Amy Henderson, CEO and co-founder of TendLab. TendLab is a Bay Area consulting firm that runs parenting and work discussions, as well as consultations at tech startups and other big Silicon Valley companies. So there's a lot to look forward to. See you next time.